Hello, it's Jill Burridge here, welcoming you to the autumn 2025 issue of our Talking Newspapers quarterly magazine programme, which is produced by Mark. So there's no local news this week, but this gives us the opportunity to replay some of the best articles from our archive. We begin with an interview from 2013, in which Rob Pearman chats with Peter Burley, who has been contributing to our Talking Newspaper for the past 48 years.
Well, hello, this is Rob Pearman, and my guest in the studio this month is Peter Burley. Now, you'll know the name, and as soon as I let him start to talk, you'll recognise his voice as well, because, of course, Peter delivers once a month the General Arts Coverage Arts Survey, what's coming up on the arts for primary. Peter, welcome to the studio. And let me ask you first about the monthly roundup that you do. I'm not clear how long you've been doing that and whether you started it or whether you took it over from somebody else.
I've been doing it a very long time. I am the longest serving, but not the oldest member of the editorial team. And Jenny and I both picked up wanting to do some work for the Talking Newspaper when we moved here in 1976. And I have a feeling it probably wasn't until 1977 that actually started recording. And that was back in Ray Bosfield's day. And I think Ray was probably trying to do it because he tried to do everything back in the early days. And I picked it up from him. And it's gone on ever since.
Yes, I recently read Ray's book about the origins. I didn't realise you were right back in the beginning of it. I must have missed that bit. It says it in there, I'm sure. But where do you get all the information from? Because you do quite an extensive coverage of activities.
Yes, most of it actually is in published brochures, programmes of what's coming up in the next season. But a huge help in the last few years has been the internet. I'm missing fewer significant events than I would have been, say, in 1978, because there is just so much available electronically.
Okay, what are the criteria that you apply? I mean, what makes you put an item in?
Well, something that is entirely visual or requires great physical effort. So a combination of marathons and orienteering clearly is probably not going to appeal to the listenership. So we concentrate more on the spoken word and music. So those are the two main themes. And then just interesting events, things that are just slightly out of the ordinary, the things that are coming to the district you wouldn't otherwise know about. So I don't exclude things that are sort of outdoor events or whatever, but we don't do, obviously, things like art exhibitions, and that's roughly how we structure it.
Do you ever get feedback from listeners saying, oh, you never do anything about this particular venue which is near me and I like it, or do you get any feedback like that?
Yes, a couple of years ago, someone said, you never preview the Mark Yates Scarecrow Festival. And I had to say, yes, I don't, because Mark Yates isn't in our area. But I will give it a plug now. The Mark Yates Scarecrow Festival is a striking event each year.
Another striking event in your life was probably your first book, your first publication, which was not related to St Albans in any sense. We'll come to the other one later.
Yes, the first book was a follow-up from my research as a historian. It was on the French Revolution, and that coincided with the bicentenary back in 1989. As you say, a very different direction to where I am at the moment.
Did you find it a struggle? I mean, you were coming out of a university context in which you'd done your PhD in this area. Were you invited to write that by a publisher, or did you have to go out there and sell it in the market?
It was an invitation. There was quite a large group of us, one of whom was a commissioning editor, and we planned out a whole range of activities that would commemorate the bicentenary. And a number of things fell to me. One was an idea that I'd talked over with her, which she then said, yes, sounds like a book, and I'll get it commissioned. I also did a film festival at the National Film Theatre and a number of other articles and press coverage. But the book was definitely the most significant event.
The film festival was about what? What were you featuring?
It was the French Revolution film.
So films about the
films about the French Revolution. Yes, that was a very interesting little bit of research. Mm. I hadn't got involved in film research of any sort before. I just occasionally went to the cinema and enjoyed watching films. That's given me a more of an in-depth knowledge and interest in the cinema since doing that.
Mm. Your second book is more local to us, as it were, and is more well-known perhaps by us.
Yes, and that was also by invitation. It was because we got involved with the planning matters on Berners Heath, part of which forms the battlefield for the Second Battle of St. Albans, that we were approached by a publisher who is keeping an eye on the Wars of the Roses, who said, well, the evidence you've produced for the public inquiry about the heritage value of the battlefield sounds as if you've made a head start on being able to write a book that would fill a gap in our portfolio, which is a book specifically about the battles of St. Albans. So it took off from there.
I'm not well enough informed about the battle, and I haven't read your book yet, so I will get round to it soon. What are the most significant factors about the battles of St. Albans?
Well, the most significant factor about the first battle in 1455 is that it was the very start of the Wars of the Roses. They started here in St. Albans, and the bell that tolled the start of the War of the Roses, Bet Gabriel, is still in the clock tower and still ringing the hour. The most significant thing about the second battle, and if you've been following the White Queen, you will, of course, be ahead of me on this. In the very opening sequence of the White Queen, you see a man being killed. And that man was the husband of Elizabeth Woodville. And he was killed on Berners Heath. And because he was killed, she became a widow. And because she was a widow, she was able to marry Edward IV. So the whole sort of structure of the royal family ever since 1461 dates from the aftermath of the Second Battle.
And you mentioned St. Bernard's Heath there. Are there any other locations in St. Albans that are particularly relevant to the battle?
Well, the whole of the city centre is the battlefield for the first battle. So it's the most accessible and intelligible of any British battlefield, and incredibly underrated. I mean, you can be certain, because of the streets to within a couple of feet where things happened, and because the Abbey was a pioneer in timekeeping, you can be sure to within minutes of when events took place. And there's no other battlefield that has that precision.
You're talking about the area up from the Abbey right up to St. Peter's. What do you mean by the city centre?
The battlefield is in roughly a sort of box, and the eastern side of the box is Marlborough Road, Upper Marlborough Road, Keyfield Terrace. Southern side of the box is Thopwell Lane. Then it runs across to the sort of marketplace, St. Peter's Street, and then along what's now Victoria Street. And that gives you a sort of box within which all the action took place.
And would you not expect to find this more easily mapped on the ground now, that one could follow a trail almost?
Yes. That said, I will give a plug where it's due. This is something the museum is very conscious of, together with the tourist office, and sorting out that first battlefield is a priority for the current Heritage Lottery bid to rebase the museum in the Old Town Hall, which is, of course, the very centre of the battlefield of the First Battle of St. Albans. While that's hanging fire, we aren't sort of going off at half cock putting up rogue signs here or there. But it is definitely a plan, and they will want to have a Wars of the Roses gallery and full interpretation so people can really understand and enjoy this absolutely unique battlefield.
And is St. Peter's Church the top end of the battle site?
It's just north of the battlefield. We think that the orientate myself to where we are sort of at the moment, but about halfway up St. Peter's Street, about where sort of Holland and Barrett is probably as far north as the casualties were incurred. A lot of, nearly all the people who were killed in the battle were buried at St. Peter's, and that's its really big claim to fame in the aftermath of the battle.
But that wasn't where they found the remains of Richard III.
No, he was under a car park in Leicester.
But you were quoted recently on that because there was some suggestion that there was some connection. I can't remember the story.
Well, it's not my connection, it's Shakespeare's. Shakespeare, for dramatic reasons, makes Richard III one of the key players in the First Battle of St. Albans, and he personally kills the Duke of Somerset in a duel. And that was outside what's now Connell's estate agents, not the Skipton Building Society, because the plaque got put on the wrong side of the road. It makes very good drama and very exciting on stage. The only historical problem is that Richard III was then only 3 years old. But we followed that up, and the local paper thought that was a nice story in its own right.
Moving on from your writing and your history, I know that you have a number of other activities that you're involved in. I'm not quite sure which is the most important in terms of your time and revenue. Which activity do you mostly spend time on?
In fact, the answer to both those questions is working on fitness to practice work for the Nursing and Midwifery Council. And I'm on what's called the Investigating Committee, where we sift the cases and also hear applications for interim suspension orders where the public needs to be protected against nurses. So, for example, if a nurse murders several patients, we immediately are able to suspend their ability to practice and go and kill some more, even if the police aren't after them already. We've had plenty of examples of that sort of quite high-profile case, although most of them are much more routine.
And they're not all local.
Oh, no, it's nationwide. Although, having said that, if you're practising in Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, you can request any hearing at which you have a right to attend takes place in that country. So from time to time, I go to Scotland, been to Wales once, and I'm still waiting to go to Belfast.
What are your qualifications to do that sort of job? I mean, you go to university, you study history, you come out with a PhD in history, you write books about history, and then you become a sort of arbitration expert or whatever the right term is.
Well, I need to backtrack to what my sort of main career was, because it was fairly clear when I finished doing research, but actually the job market in higher education more or less dried up. So I looked around for a way of earning a living, and first of all went into local government with the Greater London Council, and then specialised in getting sort of committee skills through that. That led on, when Margaret Thatcher had other ideas about my career development, led on to taking those skills sideways into the regulation of health professions. So I started doing that in 1988. So I then had a long career in various health regulators doing that work, which is what qualified me for then applying to the NMC to do the more specific side of the work, just being the fitness to practice side.
And is this so demanding that you don't have time to write another book, or are you working on one at the moment?
It's ratcheted up to being pretty near a part-time job from time to time, so it does preclude quite a lot of other things I might be doing. But no, there is still time for doing some projects. The book on the Battle of St Albans was not the point at which the work ended. It was meant to be the point, it is the point at which things move on. So we do regular local lectures about the battles. We're working with local churches. So in 2011, for example, we collaborated with St Saviour's Church and ran a two-day conference followed by a Requiem Mass 550 years late for the people who were killed at the Second Battle of St Albans. That was absolutely wonderful. The vicar was so pleased to help us. And when he realised, he's a historian as well, and when he was satisfied that there were 2,500 people buried in his parish for whom no Christian rites had ever been said, he was absolutely, literally in his element. It was just a wonderful moment for him. The conference was a huge success and very enjoyable. We're now changing our attention and moving to St Peter's Church, where we want to talk to them about their burials and their role in the Wars of the Roses. We've also got an initiative with local pubs, and in a couple of weeks' time, we're going to have a plaque unveiled in the boot, because that's where a lot of the Lancastrian soldiers would have been sitting drinking, waiting for the first battle to start, or hoping the first battle wouldn't start, more to the point, because those who were in the boot when the battle started didn't have time to put their armour on, and they suffered very badly and were then buried in St Peter's Church.
Well, coming to the boot is quite interesting. What other major buildings that are now we recognise today were important then?
Well, the Abbey, obviously. That's quite a complicated question, and you need a bit of specialised sort of architectural knowledge here. A remarkably large number of the buildings that were standing at the time of the battles are still standing, but a lot of them have got new facades. So you need to say to get your eye in, and where you see a very elegant Georgian facade with a very steeply pitched roof behind it, very often what you're looking at is a refronted medieval building. And one of the buildings to pay attention to if you're going down French Row is the old Christopher Inn, for example, is still there, but broken up into different shops now. But if you can stand back and get your eye in, you suddenly realise there's one whole building with two sort of gables at either end of it. So it's really a question of where can you stop. In the clock tower was there, the abbey was there. Waxhouse Gate's been replaced, but nonetheless was a building that makes a gesture towards being a tower at the same place. Several buildings on Holywell Hill are the same buildings. Probably some coming up Chequer Street. Well, keep on going. This was just an enormous number.
That's not, of course, the only thing you do. You're also a Justice of the Peace.
Yes.
In your other spare time, as it were. How did you get into that?
It's something I've been interested in for a long time, and it interacts very, very effectively with the fitness to practice work at the Nursing and Midwifery Council. And I applied for that more or less at the same time. We decided to downsize our careers a bit. Actually, I think I've achieved it rather better than Jenny's managed, because she's trying to do three jobs at the moment instead of none, which wasn't quite her plan. But I thought that was a manageable commitment. Went through the whole process, got appointed, but was then told there weren't any vacancies. Actually, in Hertfordshire, was offered the chance to sit on a North London bench, which is where I'm sitting now. So that's an interesting insight into a very different world to our own.
Yes, I have no experience of a magistrate's court, only of the court with a judge being on the jury, as it were. But you sit with as one of three JPs every time, or is
yes, a bench of three.
What's the range of sorts of cases that you're faced with?
Pretty well everything, in that all cases start in the magistrates' courts, but then the more important ones are quickly moved on. And I can illustrate that with one of the sort of cliches of the magistrates' world, is you never forget your first murder. And indeed, that's a memory that will stay with me. It was a tragic case for absolutely everybody concerned, including the perpetrator. So that's the most serious crime that I've actually sat in on. But last week, did a whole afternoon of railway fare evasions. So it is from the sublime to the ridiculous and sort of everything in between, up to the point where we obviously transfer the work onto the Crown Court because it's too serious.
And do you see any great changes in the sort of cases that are coming through? Does the current recession austerity have an impact on the sorts of crimes, or is that too vague?
I think it's a little bit too early to tell. And the reason for that is there's a unique factor operating in the area where I sit, which is the aftermath of the 2011 riots. And an awful lot of the court's regular customers were involved in the riots. And while they were inside, there was actually a significant dip in the amount of petty crime going on. And now I think we've got to the point where that dip should be evening out and things should kind of return to a more even pace. But that was an interesting local factor. Something quite different was, I was told, oh, you're sitting in the Tottenham area, you'll see lots of football violence. I've only had one case. Whatever Tottenham Hotspur Football Club has done, it's worked. We are not getting any football violence cases.
What's the sort of scope of sentencing that you can put a JP?
Up to 2 years now. Okay. But we very rarely send people to prison. It's much more usually fines or community service.
Mm-hmm. Peter, I'm watching the clock and we've run out of time, which is frustrating. Yes. Because I'm sure we could talk about a great deal more. And no doubt we will find an occasion
to do so. I wanted to tell you all about my other work, accrediting medical diagnostic imaging technology, but maybe another time.
Another time. Thank you very much, Peter.
Next, Kerry Pollard tells us about the St Albans Night Shelter charity, Open Door.
My guest in the studio today is Kerry Pollard. One of the things that is very dear to his heart is the charity Open Door.
Open Door provides initially nighttime shelter for people who are rough sleepers, and it does it very well and has done it for many, many years. Started about 27 years ago, and it came about because a group of city centre churches thought that there was this need for some shelter. I joined in. We started off with 6 mattresses over a shop in Victoria Street that used to be BSM, and upstairs we had the 6 mattresses. We had a kettle, we had a toaster and a sink, and that was it. So they came in and registered 2 or 3 nights. Didn't have anybody, and gradually it was full every single night. It was staffed by volunteers, mainly from the churches, but the wider community joined in as well. I used to laugh because we had vicars coming in and you knew exactly what they were doing. The sermon next day was going to be about the work that was done in the Open Door. And that was fantastic because it broadcast what we were trying to do, the need, how it was being satisfied. And then eventually we got the premises at 8 Brickett Road, which is owned by the district council and again run by volunteers initially. But it got so big and so popular that we realised that it had to be run by professional people. And that's when we got involved with Hightown, Praetorian and Churches Housing Association, which is a small local housing association based in St Albans. And it was Margaret Lewis, who was the chairman of that group, that signed up and said that her organisation, though it was tiny, would take on this responsibility. And we're immensely grateful to Margaret for doing that. She was our first chair. She's a patron now and still is involved. Margaret Lewis is a walking saint, as far as I'm concerned, for what she did and the courage she demonstrated in taking this responsibility on.
You're dealing with, there, you said, half a dozen homeless at that stage. Has the figure kept growing?
The estimate is there's round about 40 rough sleepers, and that comes from accounts that we've done, from experience. It comes from people like Emmaus who have said that these people are dropping in to see them, you know, for work and things like that. That's our estimate. It's a fluid and a moving feast, so you can't say on any one night there's 40 tonight. We really don't know that. That's just the intelligence that we've gathered and our experience over the years. We obviously can't cater for that many. We've just got to the 12 in the open door night shelter. In the winter periods, when the temperature drops below 3 degrees C, I think that's trigger mechanism, we'll put an extra 5 mattresses down in the open door shelter. And just this winter, we've had another 5 mattresses down in Trinity Church, which is just round the corner from the shelter. And then that's again run by volunteers, and we're immensely proud of that. They come from the churches generally. Churches give huge support to the concept and to the practicalities of day-to-day running. We've got round about 100 volunteers that do things within the shelter, making meals, befriending, a whole range of things. And in truth, we couldn't operate if we didn't have these, again, saintly volunteers who give up their time, no publicity, no thanks needed. We have a party once a year where we, you know, we'll put on a few sandwiches and I'll stand up and say, thank you so much for all you're doing. You cannot measure the effect that this can have on these people, you know, absolutely saving and changing lives. And I use the word saving lives because some of the clients that we have challenging problems of, you know, drug and alcohol, sometimes combined. It is those people that you are saving because it's a downward slope that they're on. What we've got to try and do is stop that.
Because there's a multiplicity of reasons. Oh. I use the term homelessness and you've used the term consistent. Rough sleepers. Do people fall out of the system somewhere? What happens?
There's varying degrees. Just to give you one example, we had a chap in not long ago who was split up from his partner and he was left homeless, either sleeping in his car or coming into the shelter. So that's one group of people that we cater for. And there's more and more of that coming along now because it's hellish difficult buying one home in St Albans or renting one home, never mind you know, having to have two. So that's part of it. And others are people who've been sleeping rough for years and years and years and know no other lifestyle. And I think we cater for them as well. What we want to do is to stop this circular movement of 28 days in a night shelter, then out for a period and then another 28 days back in again.
That's not a limit you impose, though.
What we try and do is make sure that in the 28 days, we can, if possible, do something helpful with them and move them on to some other more suitable and less temporary accommodation. That's the idea. So the 28 days gives us an opportunity to do some work. It also means that the 12 that are being catered for in that 28-day period, there's 20 more outside who could want to use the facility as well. So we've got to be careful about that. So it's designed so that within the 28 days, where we can, we'll do something more positive and make other arrangements for the people who are in the shelter. And then those others who are waiting in line can then be given their chance to come.
Sure. We'll come back to the future because I know that you're quite excited about the general trend of what might happen, what you're planning and so on. Let's keep where we are at the moment. 40 is a lot of people. And I think probably most people in St Albans would say, well, I don't see 40 around at night time in the door. I mean, where are they?
They're all over the place.
Oh, you've got 12 in your hostel.
They are all over the place. Sometimes hidden, just minding their own business. They're in all sorts of different places. I've heard about one was in a churchyard in Wheat Hampstead quite recently. So anywhere. What you see is a sleeping bag outside Marks and Spencer's and people give them money and that's okay. I have a little difficulty giving money personally because if people are drug and alcohol dependent, then you can be feeding them.
Whereas if you can give sandwiches.
You give a sandwiches or a hot drink or something, that's much better. Yeah. And anybody I speak to, I encourage them to do that. In fact, I went to talk to the city school only a few weeks ago. I suggested to them that they shouldn't do that. And one boy stood up, he said, I'm going to tell my dad that. His dad always slips a couple of quid in, you know, and then they always get thanked. And that person might not be a drug and alcohol dependent. I'm not saying that. They all are. But I still think the advice would be give them sustenance, but not financial sustenance.
The hostel itself is a building. It's not far from the city centre. And it's got a number of what? It's, dormitories? Separate rooms? What is it?
It's got 12 separate rooms, each one with its own, with obviously bed and wardrobe, but also got a shower and toilet inside. So it is self-contained. And that's the first stage of restoring dignity and self-esteem. Not sharing a everything. You're not sleeping outside. You can shower, you can keep yourself clean. And it's very interesting that majority of the clients we have are male. Occasionally you get some ladies in. And if you look at the rooms, it's pretty clear which are the ladies' rooms and which are the gents' rooms.
They're coming in about 6 o'clock.
They book in, they get allocated their room, and they can go up and shower, do whatever they want to do, get their backpack put down and hopefully put their clothes away in the wardrobe. The meal will be at whatever time it's set for. There'll be a choice, cater for vegetarian as well. So it's not beans on toast. It is really, really good food.
And is there a sort of common room that then?
Yeah, there's a big common room. Half it's got tables and chairs in, so that's where they would eat. And then the other half has got television and three, I think, computer consoles, so they can work on a computer. Okay. So when we were talking about what we could get them for Christmas, they wanted cheap mobile phones. You know, it says it all, doesn't it? Moved into the 21st century, so people were saying, I'll send a brush and a comb through. Fantastic. You know, of course they need, absolutely. But what they wanted above all else was a mobile phone that was cheap and cheerful and that they could just talk to each other. So there's kind of a society that these people have got where they chat to each other.
The night is finished, they've had their night's sleep, they have breakfast and then they have to go?
They have to go. And quite often they go to Centre 33 and we work very closely with them. Fantastic organisation.
Because they're day only, aren't they?
They're day
Your
only.
Your night yeah. only, as it were.
Yeah, absolutely. So we complement each other. And one of our trustees is a trustee of Centre 33 and of Open Door. We couldn't be closer. And we're really appreciative of all the work that Centre 33 does. Fantastic operators.
We saw on television over this wretched cold winter we just had that some of the rough sleepers didn't want to go into hostels because they were in big rooms and they didn't like being in the sort of the almost like a ward of people because they were fearful in some cases because they could have things stolen. And you've overcome that.
The clients that we have are generally insecure. And that's a manifestation of that insecurity, isn't it? You know, if they are living rough, they've got very few belongings. It's got to fit in a backpack, so they don't come with three suitcases. And this is what will be a rucksack or just a plastic bag with stuff in. Sometimes they'll come with a dog, and we try and accommodate that where we can. A dog is a man's best friend. Quite often, it is the only companion that these clients will have. So you've got to recognise that and act appropriately.
Can't be many hostels that have got separate rooms.
I've been all over the country looking at hostels. We are the best by a country mile. And that's not set out of vanity or big-headedness. It's because we've been doing it a long time and have got to the point now where I don't think we could offer a better overnight service than we do because of what we provide. What we've got to do now is to move on. So it's stage two. And I think we...
If you've got 12 inside Open Door, and does that mean you've got a queue outside or do people know that they can't get in that night? How does it work? If I was a rough sleeper, if I was homeless, how would I know whether I can get in?
You go along and try and book in. And if it's full, then they will tell you it's full and then you have to go away. And come back another day.
Would you literally have to come back each day and say, have you got room for me?
So that's it, I'm afraid. And that's one of the reasons why I think we're not sure how many homeless people, because if you go along and you do it one or two nights and you turn and you say, oh, nuts to that, I'm not going to bother anymore. And that's, again, where the hidden homeless come about, because those people will just disappear into wherever they are and become a part of a silent, hidden group.
Is Open Door more than the hostel? Do you go out looking for people who are rough sleeping?
We have a worker and her sole role is to go out into the community, searching out where rough sleepers are, to take their details down, encourage them to come in and make use and tell them what is there. We're just about to suggest that this person does evening work and night work, but that will be difficult on your own. So we're going to ask to a volunteer system where a volunteer will go out with the person, because it could be, you know, if you're walking through a park at 10 o'clock at night, you're chancing your arm a little bit. So we have a duty of care, we exercise, or we are going to exercise. She doesn't go out in the evening time yet. And she sends us a report about, you know, Mr. X, who's doing whatever, what she's doing and trying to do to encourage them to come in, see us, take part in what's going on. And that's how it is working.
So you're communicating to the people whose needs you're trying to fulfil. How do you communicate with the general public?
We, for example, are doing a street stall on the 7th of April where we'll have nice glossy leaflets and we're printing little cards. And on the card will be the address of Open Door and on the other side of the card, the address of Centre 33. We're going to hand them out to anybody that can take them away. We'll give them to the police, community support. support officers, all range of people. So if they come across anybody who is rough sleeping, they say, try this. It might work, but it's a way of getting the message across. And that's one of the things that we're just starting to do.
You still do the sleep out?
We don't do the sleep out. The sleep out's done generally by the Abbey, and we get a cut of the takings. They're very grateful for that. They do it every single year for us. We've just started another one. One of the senior staff in Notcuts approached me and said, Notcuts would like to do something for the community. What can we do to help? We are in dialogue with them, and that's again part of the future we'll come to.
Do you depend upon the community for funds? Do you depend upon volunteering? You said you got 100 volunteers or thereabouts, and it's the churches that started, the churches are still involved. Do you sense that the community as a whole understands what's going on?
I think it does, particularly the churches and the schools. Both are singularly helpful. The schools will have a song evening or something like that and raise £250 and send that through to us. But it's not just the sending the money through, it's thinking about it and knowing that there are these people who have dropped out of society for whatever reason and that they want to do a little bit for them. It's fantastic. We also get plenty of 14, 15 year olds who want to do volunteering, and because of their age they can't do it. But how excited that at that tender age they've got the wherewithal and the thoughts and the conscience and all of that and sensitivity to recognise that there are these people and they want to help. I mean, that fills me with real confidence that those young people going forward with a real sense of community and wanting to help.
You're quite confident in other ways. I mean, I've been holding you back because you want to talk about where you want to go next. I mean, you've got the hostel established, you've got a system established that is working, but in a sense you're not solving the problem, are you? Can you solve the problem?
You put your finger right on it. I felt for a couple of years now we've been marking time, and that's not a negative thing. We're providing the basic service of in you come, 28 days, we'll try to get you rehoused in the meantime. But what we want to do now is to actually move forward in a much more positive and bespoke way, so that we will identify Mr. X or Miss X, talk to them, see what we can do, what we can offer, what their real need is. Are they, for example, just from a broken home, and if we could get them into a bedsit for a while and a little bit of support, that will be them moving forward and back into society. That's fine. There will be others, of course, with more complex needs that will require a little more than that. And as one of our trustees is a mental health specialist and can arm around the shoulder, not in any questioning way, but in a positive, friendly, maternal way that can help them and identify what might be possible for this person and how we can best help them. And that, again, might be moving them into a temporary accommodation, but sitting with them, I don't mean, 24 hours a day, but sitting with them in every way to identify if there is some positive help that we can give in, might need to see a psychiatrist or some, and we can go along with them to the doctors to help, so that they don't, they're not shy of being part of the system anymore, nervous about it, that they've got somebody firmly holding their hand in a very supportive way, that kind of thing. And then if there is long-term need, seeing them through that and then moving them on into whatever we can do in the way of accommodation, with the eventual aim of getting them back full-time into society with a job paying taxes. Sounds mercenary. It's not mercenary, because it's for their benefit and the benefit of society generally, because I think for a long time this has been a problem for many, many years, going back dozens and dozens of years. It's not a recent phenomenon, and there are shelters all over the country of people doing really good work. And I think there's an understanding now, an acceptance that we have to do more. And doing more is what we aim to do. And so I've shared some of the things that we will do. There'll be many more than that. And each individual, as I said, will get a bespoke solution, or we hope a solution. And this may take 2 or 3 years. It may be done in 6 months. Who knows? But it will be tailored to the individual. And we will work hard to do that. And it will involve volunteers doing all sorts of different things. Maybe helping cleaning even in the flat, because you don't clean up if you're sleeping rough. Making sure that they maintain good health, cleanliness, so that if they are eventually going for a job, they're not going looking as if they've just come out of the forest. They're going looking as if they've just come from home having a shower, So there's a whole range of building in every sense. Self-sufficiency, self-esteem, which is really important, because your self-esteem is at a very, very low ebb when you're in the position that these people are.
What do you want from the listeners?
We want support. We will be going out fundraising shortly. If you see rough sleepers in the sleeping bag, give them sustenance, food and a hot drink, a latte, they're up for that. And be friendly, so that you recognise that these are human beings with their own needs and aspirations, the same as all of us, and we want them back in society. The aim has to be in St Albans over the longer term, and to get so that the night shelter is only has 3 or 4 people in on a night, so we've got spare beds. What a day that will be! We'll have a party to celebrate that.
Kerry, thank you very much indeed for talking about Open Door. I look forward to seeing how that project goes on developing.
Thank you.
Now we'd like to replay a conversation from our Talking Bookshelf series, in which Deborah Heath and Rob Pearman discuss Roald Dahl's Boy, which relates tales of his childhood in the 20s and 30s.
The last time that Deborah Heath was in the studio, and Deborah Heath, you remember, is a writer and a musician and a performing arts educator. That's a summary of some of the activities that she's involved in. Now, today she's come here to talk about a book by an author we all know, Roald Dahl. And I'm going to ask you why you chose Boy. I mean, he's famous for lots of different things.
I've chosen it because we're in his centenary year. Everyone seems to be buzzing talking about Roald Dahl. He's all over the place. He was in the Library Children's Challenge over the summer. My children are absolutely potty about him at the moment. My older one has gone through a list of it's about 20 books, and he's ticking them off as he goes. So he's very much in the ether at the moment. As a child myself, I actually didn't like his books very much, apart from Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and this book, Boy, which I first read at 11, and it's just so many parts of it have just stuck with me all through my life, little bits I can just quote. And I think now, although I didn't like him as a child because I found his stories really weird and disturbing, now as an adult, I'm able to appreciate them more. I know tales of the unexpected, and having read Boy, I can understand why his stories are a little bit peculiar and macabre. So I have a great admiration for him. And a point that might be very relevant to some of your listeners, Rob, is that he was actually blind for a few months. I read this in Going Solo, which is a sequel to Boy. So now I feel I've got something I share with Roald Dahl particularly. So I have a lot of respect for him, and it's just, I think it's a marvellous book.
You've mentioned it's 100 years, 1916, that he was born. Mm. And Boy really takes us through his childhood and, yes, and into the later part of his childhood. He didn't start out writing for children, he started out writing for adults.
In Going Solo, I think he mentioned his first piece of writing that he was paid for was an account of a terrible accident he had in the RAF, the one that actually ended up with him being blind for several months. And he was a little frustrated because he was trying to write an account and they put a twist on it to make it sound like he was shot down as a brave soldier. I think I'm right in saying that was his first piece of paid writing work. So that would have been in the mid-40s.
Yes, and then in the 40s and 50s he was writing a lot of short stories and really didn't come to children's literature as we know it. And Charlie and the Chocolate Factory and
Charlie and the Great Glass Elevator is the second one. And I recently found out there was going to be a third, Charlie and the Great White House. But he only wrote a couple of chapters, decided it wasn't very good, and chucked it away.
Okay, so Boy takes us more or less from his birth, and yep, we discover that he's actually Norwegian.
His father came from Norway, where before he came to England, he lost an arm in some terrible accident, came over with his wife. They had two or three children. Then the wife died, I think in childbirth, but certainly the child was very young. He very quickly remarried another Norwegian lady, who then went on to have three or four more children. So Roald was one of a very large family where the children were very spread out in age. So he refers to his ancient half-sister who was 12 years older than him or something. So his parents were of Norwegian origin and they used to go back there for every summer holiday, but they felt very English and had a lot of respect for the English school system.
Because his father had this terrible injury which led to a misdiagnosis. I mean, we're talking about the 19th century and that misdiagnosis meant that the doctors or the medical, whoever it was responsible, I can't remember, instead of solving the problem, actually destroyed his arm.
Yeah, amputated.
And he had to have it amputated because he'd been destroyed. And I think surgery plays a part in Dahl's thinking as well, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. At a young age, I believe, one of his lovely holidays in Norway, his mother said, "We're just going to the doctor. It shan't take a minute." And the poor boy, who must have been about 8 years old, had his adenoids removed with no anaesthetic. How horrible. There's another account of his boarding school days where a boy had a boil lanced by surprise when the doctor threw a towel in his face to distract him. His sister, his ancient half-sister, had her appendix removed on the nursery table. It's just, this is how things happened then, but goodness me, a lot of them seem to have happened to Roald and his family.
It's quite a short book, and yet he gets so many horrible incidents into it. But it is nonetheless amusing, it's engaging, and it's not quite as horrible as it may seem, but it's a mix of the real life.
Yes, indeed.
In fact, they lived in Wales in the beginning, because his business was all about shipping and so on, and he was looking for somewhere where there was a lot of coal.
Yes, and a port.
And that's why they got into South Wales. And it was there, presumably, that the tragedies began to arise in his family.
Yes.
Because there was the death of a sister.
There was a death of a sister, which he touched on. Also, he then, as a parent, went on to lose some of his own children, which must have been terrible, having to lose so many people close to him. But I suppose it happened in those days. As we'll probably discuss later, the medical system was very, very different to what it is now, and very, very sad. Of course, if his father hadn't lost his first wife, Roald wouldn't have been born, and we wouldn't have had lots of stories.
It should have been an idyllic situation for him, because he had lots of brothers and sisters. They were all well settled, they were comfortably off, they had no money problems. But then, unfortunately, his father also died. The book describes he's never actually got over the death of the child. It was the death of the child that made him lose the will to live, as
it were. Heartbroken. So his mother, goodness me, had her own very young children, had to be a stepmother, and just had to get on with it. I've got a lot of admiration for her. He had a great sense of family, Roald Dahl, and I think if you look at his first boarding school, he speaks about how important it was to always go to sleep facing his family. This was in a school in Weston-super-Mare, and he used to line himself up with the Bristol Channel and make sure that his back was never on his family, and he slept that way every night, I believe, in every school that he was at. He would always face his family. I think that's lovely, don't you?
Less lovely are some of the things he got up to as a young child. The sweet shop incident, well, there's various sweet shop incidents.
Yes, a terrible old Welsh lady who had very, very dirty fingers and nails filled with soil that she would thrust into jars and bring out bootlaces and gobstoppers. Gobstoppers, you notice, this will come out in Charlie and the Chocolate Factory.
Because the description that he gives of this woman, I think it was Mrs. Pratchett.
Pratchett.
It was quite indicative of the sort of characterisation that he would develop later.
By far the most loathsome thing about Mrs. Pratchett was the filth that clung around her. Her apron was grey and greasy. Her blouse had bits of breakfast all over it, toast crumbs and tea stains and splotches of dried egg yolk. It was her hands, however, disturbed us most. They were disgusting. They were black with dirt and grime. They looked as though they'd been putting lumps of coal on the fire all day long. And don't forget, please, that it was these hands and fingers that she plunged into the sweet jars when we asked for a pennyworth of treacle toffee or wine gums or nut clusters or whatever.
He's obsessed with sweet shops. My son brought home a book called The Giraffe, The Pelly and Me, which is a lesser-known Roald Dahl story. It's all to do with the sweet shop and the signs outside the sweet shop. So I think he was obsessed with chocolates and sweeties, wasn't he? But this horrible, horrible shopkeeper always had her evil eye on Roald and his friends when they went in, and they decided to get their own back on her one day when they found a dead mouse, and they thought it would be a very good idea, or Roald himself thought it would be a very good idea, to give her a shock, to put it into a jar of sweets and see what happened.
He went through lots of different schools, I mean, and they got up to various things, as you say.
Yes, and getting caned. I think that was the first time he was caned. First of many times.
Yes, that's an element that runs right through chapter after chapter, being caned.
He had a more interesting experience at his next school. He also got caned a fair bit then, but I think he had some wonderful experiences there, certainly in terms of fodder for his writing. There's a wonderful story about him walking in on a matron in the throes of a romantic entanglement with one of the masters. And it's nice to have these little pockets of humour throughout what would be a rather disturbing book.
It could well be quite disturbing, because there's so many descriptions of teachers beating young children endlessly, and Dahl is either being beaten or watching somebody else being beaten, and one of the ones that beat him ended up as Archbishop of Canterbury.
Yes, I think he was Bishop of Chester and then Bishop of London, and then he became Archbishop of Canterbury.
I think he was the one that crowned the Queen. And he describes very well this man, and he poses questions about the man and how he came to be such a well-known religious leader.
Then the instrument of torture was put once more upon the table, and a box of matches was produced. A match was struck and applied to the pipe. The pipe failed to light properly. A fourth stroke was delivered with the lecture continuing. This slow and fearsome process went on until 10 terrible strokes had been delivered. And all the time, over the pipe lighting and the match striking, the lecture on evil and wrongdoing and singing and misdeeds and malpractice went on without a stop. It even went on as the strokes were being administered. At the end of it all, a basin, a sponge, and a small, clean towel were produced by the headmaster, and the victim was told to wash away the blood before pulling up his trousers. Do you wonder, then, that this man's behaviour used to puzzle me tremendously? He was an ordinary clergyman at that time, as well as being headmaster, and I would sit in the dim light of the school chapel and listen to him preaching about the Lamb of God and mercy and forgiveness and all the rest of it. And my young mind would become totally confused.
There's another teacher he speaks of a lot to. A poor man, he got shell shock in the war and it is very, very jittery. And they're very unkind to him. Roald isn't a perfect child, he's unkind to a few people. But it is usually justified, like in the system of murder mysteries, you know, in Agatha Christie books. There are some terrible murders, but they always happen to people who thoroughly deserve them. And I think Roald has a great sense of right and wrong and people getting their just desserts. And I think that certainly comes through in his writing. And he speaks very, very sadly about a time he was unjustly accused of cheating in prep, and all that happened was he broke his nib, and this really had a very bad impact on him at the time.
He also comes back to chocolates at a later stage, doesn't he? Tell me what's going on here.
I think this is one of the highlights of his childhood, and this was in his last school, where the Cadbury's people, really the children, became quality assurance officers. They would send in samples of new exciting chocolate bars. They would ask these poor boarding school children to eat the bars and let them know what they thought about them. That's absolutely marvellous. And it's an obvious link to Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. It probably developed Roald's sense of style as a writer, even just beginning with reviews. But I think that must be absolutely marvellous. That is one of the aspects of this book that has stayed with me that I've remembered ever since I was 11. One of the reasons I wanted to read it again. And it's a section that my own children are very excited about.
For me, the importance of all this was that I began to realise that the large chocolate companies actually did possess inventing rooms, and they took their inventing very seriously. I used to picture a long white room like a laboratory, with pots of chocolate and fudge and all sorts of other delicious fillings bubbling away on the stoves, while men and women in white coats moved between the bubbling pots, tasting and mixing and concocting their wonderful new inventions. I used to imagine myself working in one of these labs, and suddenly I would come up with something so absolutely unbearably delicious that I would grab it in my hand and go rushing out of the lab and along the corridor and right into the office of the great Mr. Cadbury himself. "I've got it, sir," I would shout, putting the chocolate in front of him. "It's fantastic. It's fabulous. It's marvellous. It's irresistible."
Looking at the sort of extracts that we've pulled out, the sweet shop, the character in the sweet shop, the character of the bullying teachers, or the teachers who didn't realise it was bullying at the time, didn't realise it was abuse. All of these clearly play a part in his life. He says in the beginning of the book, this is not autobiography.
It makes me think about a module I did when I was a drama student about autobiography and performance, and I think we can relate this to written autobiography as well. And we have to ask ourselves, what is autobiography? Is it more authentic if you're reading an autobiography, or a collection of someone's letters or their diaries, or perhaps an autobiography that is peppered with these throughout? The problem with autobiography as a concept is that we never really know what's true and what isn't. And indeed, the writer may remember things incorrectly. Yes, it might help to have your diary entries. And he does say himself, "I can't remember the name of this child," or "I can't remember the name of this teacher, but he was an ugly devil," you know, that sort of thing. I feel Roald Dahl is being fairly honest, because he does doesn't always paint himself in a good light. I couldn't recount tales in this way. I have kept some diaries from when I was at school, you know, just in case I become very, very famous. I can remember a few funny stories, but not to this extent. It's extraordinary. He wrote this, I think, when he was about 60. Very good memory. So he doesn't call it an autobiography. Does he call it an account of his childhood?
He says that he'd never write a history of himself. None of the things that happened to him are important, but each made a tremendous impression. He didn't have to search. All I had to do was skim them off the top of my consciousness and write them down.
Well, he was quite a humble person, wasn't he? He's never boasted very much about his writing. He lived in quite a simple situation, really. He wrote every day in the same old chair in a very dusty old study. An amazing chair, mind you, that he'd had made specially for him, with a sort of lap tray that would pull across. I don't know if you've ever seen it in his museum. But yeah, he wasn't a boastful person. So I think he'd never understand why people would particularly want to read his autobiography. He just hopes it might amuse them and divert them, which it does. So to my mind, it's a good introduction to autobiography for children. And it is very much aimed at, I would say, the 9 to 15 age bracket. We can enjoy it as adults, but it's very accessible and very relevant to that age group.
It didn't strike me that it wasn't also a book for adults because there's a lot of social comment in there. There's a lot of things that one thinks about. The first time I read it, I thought, I don't know, is this really particularly profound? I actually went back to it and looked at it again and listened to it. And I enjoyed listening to it very much, actually, because it works very well as an audio book. And I think it's really more than that. And his second volume, which I haven't read, the second part of his Going Solo, is it? Mm. Yes. What's that? That takes it through to the...
Okay, so this one leaves off at the age of 18 and Going Solo takes it forward. Mainly through the war years. So pre-war years, when he's working in Africa, and there's a wonderful story about a lion stealing the cook's wife. Lots of really funny stuff, some really upsetting stuff. He talks about his harrowing experiences flying solo in an aeroplane. That's where it gets its name from. But it's also about going solo throughout his life. He was out there away from his mother for 4 years. He didn't see his family or speak to them for 4 years. He was absolutely on his own. So that's an amazing book. I think it is even more harrowing than Boy, and I would recommend if anyone's read Boy, they go on to read Going Solo. So that takes him roughly to the end of the war.
Well, I haven't read it, so I didn't know about the lion stealing the cook's wife. I mean, that is straight out of Roald Dahl Horrid Tales or something, isn't it?
It is. It's marvellous. He does have a macabre side, but he also has a superb sense of humour.
Deborah, thank you very much indeed.
You're welcome.
Our thanks to Caliber Audio for providing us with a CD from which we could take those extracts. Boy by Roald Dahl was read by Tony Lister.
Next, Howard Gard, writer and director of A County at War, tells me about the key elements of the film, which was made in 2014 as part of Hertfordshire's contribution to the nationwide remembrance of the beginning of World War I 100 years earlier. As well as commemorating the Hertfordshire Regiment, this film is the story of the people left at home. It features the part women played in the war effort, and also features the role Hatfield House played in the development of the tank. 100 years ago, between July and November 1917, the fields of Flanders witnessed one of the bloodiest episodes of the First World War. What took place was officially known as the Third Battle of Ypres, but history recalls the horror as Passchendaele. As a pre-war territorial unit, the men of the Harts were part-time soldiers coming from all walks of life. The 1st Battalion Hertfordshire Regiment were the only infantry unit from the county to see service overseas, serving on the Western Front from November 1914. But at Passchendaele, the Hertfordshire Regiment's 620 men and officers were virtually wiped out in the first 2 hours of fighting on July the 31st, 1917. And all the regiment's officers and 75% of the other ranks were either killed, wounded, or captured. To mark the centenary, the Hearts at War Community History Project has unveiled a monument to the Hertfordshire Regiment at the battlefield. Hertfordshire's then Lord Lieutenant, Lady Verulam, was there, and so too was Howard Gard, a deputy lieutenant and the author and director of a film called A County at War, which was made in 2014 to mark Hertfordshire's contribution to the First World War effort. And Howard joins me now. What you did pull out was the personal photographs of, of families who have lived for generations in Hertfordshire. And then the other powerful images came when preparations for war were really being made. And you used a lot of the photographs from the Holland Hibbert family archive. They live near Watford. And those images of, I think his name was Thurston. His wife travelled with him.
To Egypt. And that was quite common, not to France, but definitely to Egypt. It wasn't unusual. She became a nurse, a VAD nurse, which was a volunteer auxiliary. He ended up being wounded at Gallipoli, and although she had come home earlier before he was wounded, she ended up nursing him, and he was quite seriously wounded.
The other thing that surprised me was the influx of refugees. I think when war broke out, the film says that there were 1.5 million refugees who took to the road. And somebody called Lady Lugard actually founded the War Refugees Committee.
In the first days of the war, there was no official news, no television, no telephones for people to say what was happening, where or when. There was just this awful rumblings. And a few refugees came across, and then it suddenly turned into a flood. And she learned all of that from doormen at London clubs. And I've always imagined that the doorman knew what was going on, because the only telephone in the club would be in the lobby, and the doorman would listen to the phone calls that the generals were receiving, because they seemed to be better informed than anybody else. But then there was no BBC. She very quickly sprang into action, and she said this immortal line, "Something must be done."
And she did just that. She founded the War Refugees Committee.
Passant par-dessus la Manche une seconde fois, elle est donc s'était repris en cœur par mille voix. C'est celui que les Tommy chantaient déjà chez nous. Quand ils
In 6 weeks, 200,000 Belgian refugees would arrive.
And she got a group of ladies together, all of whom took 2,000 refugees. And 2,000 came to Letchworth. But within days, very, very quickly. And stayed until 1919.
It's interesting, too, that women at all levels of society played an instrumental role in the First World War, didn't they? I mean, at the higher level, Lady Lytton, I think, opened a hospital at Nebworth.
There's a wonderful photograph of her with Queen Mary, where she invited Queen Mary to watch a female surgeon operate on a man. Now, first of all, there were no female surgeons. At the start of the war, there were only 100 who had passed their exams, and they were mainly gynaecologists and paediatricians. So it was a very unusual thing to have a female surgeon, and it was an entirely inconceivable thing that the Queen would then go and see an operation. And Queen Mary was absolutely wonderful. She was a pillar of strength, and I think, I'm sure, had a great sense of humour as well. I think she wasn't dour in any way, although she had some pretty frightening photographs in her later years. But as a young woman, she was very fetching and very upright and dignified. And I had this photograph of them in the operating theatre. It's just the two of them watching something. And there's a personal bodyguard, a man in a morning dress behind the Queen. And one of her ladies-in-waiting had fainted and gone out. I knew this from the diaries. And I had it for weeks longer. I put it in the film. And then I suddenly saw that her right hand had gone through Lady Lytton's arm. And she was not clinging on because she was feeling wobbly. She was actually, in a very dignified way, saying, "Well done, this is very good." And Lady Lytton is looking down, and she is so startled because she's looking down at this hand, this gloved hand on her elbow. And of course, royalty didn't go around touching people. So it was a complete surprise to Lady Lytton, and it was a complete surprise to me when I spotted it. Mm. So I covered that by zooming in very slowly towards this black glove. Well, you would never have got that on a film, you see.
No.
So we discovered all kinds of things within the pictures.
Hertfordshire had 38 voluntary aid detachment hospitals, and it is estimated that the volunteers who manned them treated as many as 150,000 men. Without their help, the system would have collapsed.
And at Hatfield House, I think women ran a sort of logging campaign,
yes,
did they?
It was the Women's Voluntary Service and the Women's Land Army, both of which were started by Lady Verulam's grandmother.
And Hatfield House became the sort of centre of this.
Yes, well, by 1917, we were in a lot of trouble because, in fact, while we had managed to blockade Germany and very few supply ships from anywhere in the world were getting through to Germany, it was equally true that the German Navy, their U-boats, were sinking an awful lot of the ships destined for England. So we had real food shortages, but in Germany, they had real starvation. I can't remember if it's 700 or 7,000 people actually died of starvation. It's a startling number, even if it was 10.
You mentioned the tanks in the actual Battle of Passchendaele earlier on, but Hatfield House was also the location for a demonstration of this new weapon, the tank.
Yeah.
And I think the Marquess of Salisbury staged this exhibition on his golf course.
He did.
And again, invited all the great and the good.
Absolutely. And all the doubters and the naysayers, because still in 1915, horses were judged to be necessary to the army. The vast majority of the general staff didn't get it. They didn't get mechanized transport. There was a very small group in the army who had pursued the possibility of having a mechanized vehicle that could go over very rough ground. And there was a company in Lincolnshire who developed a vehicle with caterpillar tracks. And this was in 1914. So the army said, no, we don't like it. We don't see them any possibilities here. And they cancelled the order and they just had one trial vehicle, which they sold to a company in California who changed its name to Caterpillar because the men in the factory had nicknamed this vehicle the Cat. Caterpillar has become one of the biggest companies in the world. And by the end of the war, by 1918, the British government were buying thousands of Caterpillar-tracked vehicles from Caterpillar. And we had sold the rights for nothing. It's a very sobering story that we didn't back our brilliant invention. However, by 1915, the men were dying in vast numbers in no man's land. And the only hope was that there would be something like a tank. We developed the first one in secret, and Lord Salisbury got it down to Hatfield House to sell it to the top brass.
In the dead of night, on January the 27th and 28th, 1916, the weapon, nicknamed Mother, was moved along closed railway lines and roads to Lord Salisbury's private golf course. The Hearts Volunteer Regiment had built a no-man's land, with trenches modelled on the Loos network, shell holes and a swamp. Kitchener came for lunch on February the 2nd. In the following days, King George V, Lloyd George and all the top brass came to visit. And by February the 12th, the army had placed an order for 100 tanks, which saw action on the Somme in September.
Churchill, to be fair, had been involved because he had commissioned it because it was under the Navy. Tanks were judged to be vessels and it was part of the Navy and it carried naval guns. And I suppose there was a certain logic. It also, interestingly, got around people like Haig who believed staunchly in horses. It was a lot of politicking and I do believe the Salisburys are quite experienced at that.
Now, Hertfordshire also has several names, well-known names, like de Havilland and Sir Hugh Trenchard, who were instrumental in pioneering, really, the war in the air during the First World War.
And the one figure that really shook me was by the end of the First World War, because we started it with no RAF, so it was the Royal Flying Corps. In 1914, when they advertised for people to come with their own aircraft to qualify to be in the Royal Flying Corps. And they were like kites. They were just like these extraordinary things that one saw in the film, those magnificent men in their flying machines, and that's what they looked like. And they were very slow. And there is the sequence begins in the film with an aircraft flying over Watford in the first ever air race. and there were only two entrants in the air race. And the prize was £10,000, which was a fortune. And the flight was from London to Manchester. So there was this explosion. Necessity is the mother of invention. The war came along. Clearly, aircraft were going to be instrumental in not so much fighting the Red Baron, but actually in spotting what was happening on the ground, because, again, no satellites, no digital this or that, no visual aids whatsoever, basically no idea what was going on. And it was the RAF spotter aircraft that took the aerial photographs and actually reported back in real time. They dropped notes. They used to fly over the lines, scribble a note giving a compass point and drop it with a stone or something. But it made a huge difference. So these are all men that rode this colossal tide of invention. And by the end of the war, we had the biggest air force in the whole world. And it was now finally called the Royal Air Force. And a nice anecdote is that the royal family immediately saw the interest here, and they all got fitted for RAF uniforms. Everywhere they went, they started appearing in RAF uniform.
Of all the stories that emerge in the film that you made, one is very powerful, and it's the story of Private Percy Buck. And I suppose I found it very remarkable because while well-known families, established families in the county, keep archives of their own and, of course, have all these sort of photographs and mementos from the war, Percy Buck was just a private in the army. But you unearthed his story, quite a sad one. He died at Passchendaele.
This recording of Abide With Me was sung at the burial of the unknown soldier in Westminster Abbey on the 11th of November 1920. He lies beside the tombs of the kings of England. Private Percy Buck was one of the 128 men of the Hertfordshire Regiment who died at Saint-Julien that have no known grave. The Menin Gate is their only memorial. Percy had died of his wounds during the night and was found the next day by a German soldier in a shell hole. He was clutching a photo of his wife and three-year-old son. On the back was his address. The German took the photo, together with Percy's identification, and returned it to Mrs. Buck in Hitchin via the Swiss Red Cross. Because of this act of kindness, Percy's body could not be identified, and his grave was unrecorded. Another unknown soldier.
This story is sad at every single turn because the chances are he wasn't mortally wounded. He was wounded in the side, clearly didn't kill him. He was seen by his comrades falling into a shell hole, and he was found sitting up looking at his wife's photograph, who was holding their baby son. The German soldier obviously found it very poignant and handed it to the German Red Cross, who handed it to the Swiss Red Cross, and it eventually found its way back to England. But because his dog tags were removed and his identity papers were removed from his body, his grave was never marked. He is an unknown soldier. That was very poignant because there we were in the field where he obviously died, but nobody knows where his remains are.
And how did you come across the story?
Well, that is also sad because all those papers were in a tin in a loft. His wife never remarried. Their son found it when his mother died, and it was in the loft in a tin. And she had never mentioned it. But that, again, is a story in itself because this war produced an entire generation of widows or spinsters. A huge number of men died, but a huge number of women lost any possibility of marriage and or having children. And that's very much an untold story.
I mentioned that you made this film in 2014. I think you're now planning an update, a slightly different ending.
The present ending is profoundly sad. In my attempts to bind it to Hertfordshire and to give the film some structure rather than just an endless catalogue of stories and pictures, we designed maps of Hertfordshire in which we then superimposed things that had happened. So the number of wounded men, the number of men that were lost at Saint-Julien, that appears in a map, which then fades to black at the end. And very, very movingly tells the story of a quartermaster who arrived with supplies to deliver to the Hertfordshire Regiment, and he went up to the staff officer and said, "I'm looking for the Hertfordshires." And the answer came back, "There is no Hertfordshire Regiment." So that's a map of Hertfordshire covered with hundreds of crosses in red or white for wounded or dead or missing. We also have one of all the nurses, because there were hospitals everywhere, every large country house. There were just dozens and dozens of impromptu hospitals, which we estimate treated 150,000 men. The maps are all sort of aerial, and things happen within them. And we plot the course of a zeppelin that attacked Barnet and Cuffley. And we also see that zeppelin being shot down by Leif Robertson, all from still photographs, actually, but animated still photographs. So it was very challenging to do and very fruitful, very satisfying, much, much better than any real footage that we could have ever got. And then we end with the map of Hertfordshire, and three young cadets, Army, Navy and Air Force, are collecting photographs of war memorials, and they stick them on the wall. And there is, in principle, one for every village in Hertfordshire. It reflects the huge number of war memorials in all their different shapes and sizes. And I thought I would try and continue that thought. So the new ending begins with the war memorials in Belgium, and they see the oceans of graves that spread out across the Belgian landscape. And that is also incredibly moving, because it actually brings it all home. I think it is possibly difficult to relate to a stone cross in a market square where, you know, you might sit and do your shoelaces up or eat a sandwich. People just pass by war memorials here in England. But my goodness, you can't pass the cemeteries by without really thinking, wow. So as I said, whether it be 20 men or 20,000 that died there and that are buried, the war grave cemeteries are deeply moving. And so this is what that sequence is about. And it ends with Lady Verulam laying a wreath at the Menin Gate. This sequence then is introduced by the new Lord Lieutenant. So again, it's a reminder that life marches resolutely on. And I think, therefore, it's a more optimistic ending.
Now our selection of national radio programmes that you might like to listen to this coming week.
Hello, I'm David, and here are some radio highlights for this coming week that I hope you'll enjoy listening to. First, on Saturday the 27th of September, today marks the 200th anniversary of the birth of modern railways, and Petroc Trelawney marks the occasion by taking an 8-hour and 581-mile journey from Inverness to London aboard the Highland Chieftain, with interviews and celebrations along the way. Train Tracks is on Radio 3 from 7:30 a.m. all day until 5 p.m. Another anniversary this week, the actress Julie Andrews will be 90 on Wednesday, and both Radio 2 and Radio 4 Extra mark both this and the 60th anniversary of her film, The Sound of Music. Stage and Screen is on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m, followed by The Hills Are Alive, also on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. In The Forum on BBC World Service, Izzy Lawrence investigates how weddings have changed over time. The Forum is on BBC World Service at 5 past midday. And for a classic comedy episode from 1960, Beyond Our Ken is on Radio 4 Extra at 2:30 p.m. And for the Night Owls, more of Julie Andrews. Julie Andrews, the fan's story, is on Radio 2 at midnight. And then Sunday, the 28th of September. Sunday worship this morning is a harvest service from Lichfield Cathedral. You can join in Sunday worship on Radio 4 at 8:10 a.m. Actor Michael Sheen is Lauren Laverne's guest on Desert Island Discs on Radio 4 at 10 a.m, repeated on Friday at 9 a.m. In Private Passions, Michael Barclay welcomes actor Richard Armitage, exploring the many roles he has played. Private Passions is on Radio 3 at midday. Choral Evensong today comes from Westminster Abbey and marks the 80th birthday of composer John Rutter. Choral Evensong is on Radio 3 at 3 p.m. A Short History of Tractors in Ukrainian, the first episode of a two-part dramatisation of Marina Luiska's novel, is on Radio 4 at 3 p.m. And Vintage Comedy from 1975 with Frankie Howard is on Radio 4 Extra at 3 p.m. The social and cultural resonances of the pop group Kraftwerk's 1974 studio album Autobahn is in Driving, Driving, Driving on the Autobahn at 7:15 p.m. on Radio 4. And now for some programmes that are broadcast each weekday at the same time. This week's Book of the Week is Dangerous Miracle by biologist Liam Shaw, tracing the discovery, development and global use of antibiotics. Book of the Week, Dangerous Miracle, is on Radio 4 each morning at 11:45. Food Britannia is a series of 5 episodes where Max Cotton explores whether people in the UK could feed themselves entirely from homegrown produce. Food Britannia is on Radio 4 each afternoon at 1:45. Composer of the Week this week is Hector Berlioz, and you can hear 5 episodes covering his work. Composer of the Week is on Radio 3 at 4 p.m. each afternoon. This week's Book at Bedtime is the final 5 parts of Philip Roth's modern classic The Plot Against America. Book at Bedtime is on Radio 4 each evening at 10:45 p.m. And then for programmes on Monday the 29th of September. A new short series begins on the question of what it is to be a healthy child growing up in the UK in 2025. 3 Ages of Child is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. And for the day's Vintage Comedy, a 1974 episode of Dad's Army is on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. and at 6:30 p.m. In Tracking the Planet, Emily Knight explores the impact of environmental changes on animals. Tracking the Planet, Exploring the Anthropocene is on Radio 4 at 11 p.m. Radio 3 in Concert is at 7:30 p.m. with the Philharmonia Orchestra from the Royal Festival Hall at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. And at 11:30 p.m. on Radio 4, the first episode of Being Roman with Mary Beard, who uses scattered clues to rebuild the lives of citizens of the Roman Empire. Being Roman with Mary Beard, the Inquisitor, is on Radio 4 at 11:30 p.m. And then Tuesday, the 30th of September, All in the Mind on Radio 4 explores the value and roles of AI chatbots in mental health support. All in the Mind is on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. And today's Vintage Comedy Choice is a 1958 episode of The Goon Show on Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. and 6:30 p.m. And Radio 3 in Concert today brings you a programme of Rachmaninoff's Preludes. That's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Assignment Crossing Continents, John Murphy, looked at the plight of Haitian migrants in the Dominican Republic on BBC World Service at 9:30 a.m. and repeated at 8:05 p.m. and on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. And the second episode of Being Roman with Mary Beard, Death on the Nile, is on Radio 4 at 11:30 p.m. and then to Wednesday, the 1st of October. A new series, The Magnificent O'Connors, delves into a change of events that began more than 80 years ago. The Magnificent O'Connors is on Radio 4 at 9:30 a.m. The Lazarus Heist explores the cyber heist in which $1.5 billion disappeared in minutes. The Lazarus Heist is at 1:30 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. on the BBC World Service. And there's a new series of a Nordic thriller, Murder in Åland, and that's on Radio 4 at 2:15 p.m. Today's vintage comedy is a 1958 episode of Hancock's Half Hour on BBC Radio 4 Extra at 12:30 p.m. and at 6:30 p.m. And the Radio 3 concert this evening features the LPO at the Royal Festival Hall, with a programme that includes music by Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. The Radio 3 concert is at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. Being Roman with Mary Beard, the third instalment, Soldiering for Softies, shows a different side of the battle-hardened Roman soldier. And that's Radio 4 at 11:30 p.m. Next Thursday, the 2nd of October, the documentary Powering Nigeria examines the problems of electricity supply in Nigeria, a nation of 200 million people where some 80 million still do not have access to electricity. The documentary Powering Nigeria is on the BBC World Service at 9:30 a.m. and at 8:05 p.m. Rethink Nightlife examines how the pandemic affected the nightlife industry and whether it needs government intervention. Rethink Nightlife is on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. In Master Tapes, Don McLean discusses his 1971 album American Pie. Master Tapes Part 1 is on Radio 4 Extra at 4:30 p.m. with the second part tomorrow at the same time. And the Radio 3 in concert is from the Liverpool Philharmonic Hall and includes Mussorgsky's Pictures at an Exhibition. And that's on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. A special programme, Grand Old Opry Live from London, is on Radio 2 at 8 p.m. And finally, Friday, the 3rd of October, the food programme, In Search of Mustard in Norwich, asks whether the Norfolk city is in danger of forgetting its mustard heritage 5 years after the Coleman's factory left Norwich. The food programme In Search of Mustard in Norwich is on Radio 4 at 11 a.m. In Heart and Soul, the presenter visits the Esfigmenou Monastery on Mount Athos in northern Greece. Heart and Soul is on BBC World Service at 1:30 p.m. And Master Tapes on Radio 4 Extra brings you the final episode of Don McLean talking about his album American Pie. And that's Radio 4 Extra at 4:30 p.m. The News Quiz brings you the weekly comedy panel game, and that's on Radio 4 at 6:30 p.m. Friday night is Music Night. Celebrates John Rutter's 80th birthday with a programme of his music from Saffron Walden, with the BBC Concert Orchestra and Singers. Friday night is Music Night is on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m. Free Thinking, What is a Good Life? Discussion around Michael Rosen's new book, Good Days, about what it means to be good. Free Thinking, What is a Good Life? Is on Radio 4 at 9 p.m. And I hope you will enjoy or have already enjoyed some of the programmes I have selected for you this week.
Next, we bring you one of Rupert Evershed's Nature Notes.
This is Rupert Evershed reading my monthly Nature Notes for the Hearts Advertiser. Look out for the little brown birds of autumn. One of the great delights of late summer, at least when the weather is good, is sitting in the garden watching the natural world go by And go by it does at this time of year, as swallows and martins return south high overhead for the winter. The swifts have already gone, and a multitude of smaller passerines feed their way through treetops and bushes, here today, gone tomorrow. Though it would seem handy and apt at this time of year for passerine to mean passing bird, the word is actually derived from the Latin for sparrow, passer, and refers to more than half of all bird species. Technically, the scientific order Passeriformes include all perching birds, defined as those with three toes pointing forward and one pointing back, the key to balancing on a perch. If you have any trees or bushes in your garden or visit any green space at this time of year, the chances are you will encounter passerines, both perching and passing. With the more familiar garden species come a variety of scarcer birds, warblers, whitethroats, redstarts, flycatchers, and for the very lucky few, that weird and wonderful woodpecker, the wryneck. Together, they make up that plethora of little brown birds, or LBJs, little brown jobs, as they are known amongst birdwatchers, which make up much of Britain's bird population. At this time of year too, the majority of passing LBJs are particularly brown, a cohort of juveniles and females, the bright-plumaged males often having left earlier. Both the toned-down plumage and the displacement of species outside their usual habitats makes the challenge of identification that much harder, but also, at least for me, that much more exciting. That little brown bird swaying atop a tall weed in the farmer's field I would normally dismiss as just another linnet or sparrow. But take a second look, and oh, it's a whinchat, on its way south from the high moors of northern England and Scotland. If there's one thing that aids the search for LBJs, it is that they never cease moving, giving away their presence with flicks of the wing, looping fly-catching flights, or little quiet calls and clicks of the beak as they snap up the midges and gnats. Sitting out in the garden yesterday morning, a sudden movement in the blackberry stand revealed a whitethroat picking at the ripe blackberries, the first I've seen in the garden for years. Looking up at the tall birch trees, their leaves shimmering in the breeze, one hanging drape of leaves seemed to shake just that little bit more. Sure enough, in the binoculars, a bright yellow willow warbler flicked and flitted, catching flies but all the while blending perfectly with the birch foliage, brightened to a translucent yellow in the morning sunlight. Tomorrow, they will be in someone else's garden, and before long, they will liven the coastal scrubland, ready to depart our shores. How many of these little brown jobs you will see depend entirely on how much time you can spend watching and waiting. At the first sign of disturbance, these little birds will dive for cover, but after a few moments of patience, they will re-emerge and continue feeding, rewarding you with great views. Of course, a certain lack of self-consciousness helps too, as it is not always obvious to others why you might have such an intense fascination with an apparently empty bush. Of course, the bush may prove empty, but very often, usually just as you're about to give up, a sudden flash of red sets the pulse racing. A robin-sized redstart, brown apart from a flicking rust-red tail, drops down from the bush and picks an insect off the path. So regular is this pattern of discovery in some places that local birdwatchers will often dub a particular hedge as the redstart hedge and scan particularly hard each autumn in the hope of maintaining its reputation. The real bonus of this search for our little brown jobs is that it can be undertaken almost anywhere, and your garden is one of the best places to start. Chiffchaffs, whitethroats and blackcaps are the most likely, but you never know, flycatchers, redstarts or something even rarer might just choose your patch to take a break in.
And now Sean Tomlinson tells us about the mental health support provided by Mind in Mid-Herts.
My guest in the studio today is Sean Tomlinson, who has been with Mind in Mid-Herts for about 10 years, I think.
That's right, yes.
But in the last 3 years, you've been CEO.
Yes.
So that's it's your responsibility. Mm. And Mind in Mid-Herts is based in St Albans, but also...
in Stevenage, Welwyn Garden City and Hartford. And we do outreach services in North Herts and Harpenden and roundabout as well. So if people can't get to one of our centres, they should contact us and we will try and get out out to them.
If you can sum up very briefly what you do, I mean, obviously Mindy Mid Hearts is linked with Mind, which is a national name. You're an affiliate. Is that the right terminology?
So National Mind gets involved in things like research, campaigning, reducing the stigma of mental health. They lobby the government. And Mind in Mid Hearts and all the local minds across England and Wales, there's about 140, they deliver services. So National Mind don't deliver any services. Local minds will be the ones that will actually see people and help them on their journey. And there's three main themes to the work that we do. One is prevention. One is social support for people with long-term conditions. And the third one is obviously around recovery, whatever that means to the individual. That could mean just coming in to do a course on managing anxiety or coping with depression, or it could be a social support group to make new contacts, maybe build their confidence up to be social again after a spate of being unwell. And they're all very much overlap, the themes in terms of recovery and management and social support and prevention. They all really meet together. And we offer counselling, so individual counselling for people. We run a variety of different interventions that people might find helpful.
What makes people come to you?
We have a hospital discharge service, so we actually visit people while they're in hospital to really bridge inpatient to outpatient care and to make sure that when they're in hospital, they understand what's available in the community so that when they come out, they're already, you know what's going to be available and what support they can get. And then obviously people come to see us who are stressed or unwell and they want some support. A lot of the GPs will say, have you contacted Mind? Do you know about Mind? So that's generally why people come to see us and why I love opportunities to come and talk on the radio like today, because I want people to know that actually you don't have to be unwell. We want people to come and see us before they become unwell. If we can prevent somebody from becoming unwell, we'd really love to get that chance. And I think the counselling works for that. People can come just for a one-off consultation about something that they're finding tricky. Maybe you're coming up to retirement, or maybe you're having a baby and you're just feeling a bit anxious and nervous. Don't ignore those early signs. Come and talk to somebody, and they may only need one session, and that might help them to feel a little bit more confident about these life transitions, which are major stuff for people, but often can be the trigger to them feeling unwell. And that can, if they don't get the right support and help, that ends up with they need medication or they need some more specialist support.
In a way, what you're saying is almost a sort of parallel to physical health.
National Mind often talk about parity of esteem and that commissioners should be spending as much money on mental health as they are on physical health, which at the moment about 25% of the NHS budget goes on mental health and 75% goes on physical health. I don't know that they'll change that dramatically, but we want people to understand that if somebody collapses in the road and they're not well mentally, somebody doesn't say pull yourself together and get up. As if you were to fall over in the street or trip up and break your leg, nobody would say, oh, come on, pull yourself together, get up. So we want the same respect and acknowledgement for mental health as people have for physical health. And we want people to look after their mental health just like they do their physical health. They think about their diet, they think about exercise. We want people to think about their mental health in the same way. What can I do to stay well? The Mental Health Foundation did a lot of research and they published that research. It's all available online. If people Google the Mental Health Foundation, they will see the five ways to well-being. And it was proven that by practicing those five ways to well-being, just like you've got to eat your five fruit and veg a day, you've got to practice these things. And they are just simple and easy things to practice.
Give me one example, like what?
So the five things are giving, take notice, keep learning, stay connected, and exercise. None of it has to be major. Exercise could be running up the stairs instead of taking the lift, could be walking to the next bus stop instead of getting on the bus at your nearest bus stop. Just staying active, going for a walk. It can mean staying connected, can mean make that phone call that you keep meaning to make, that old friend that you haven't stayed connected with. Stay connected to your friends and family. And giving, of course, that's easy. You can do both of those at the same time, because if you make that phone call, chances are your friend or your family member who hasn't heard from you is going to be delighted. So you've given something and you've stayed connected. And then, of course, taking notice. That can be just noticing the birds are singing, or it can be noticing how you're feeling. Sometimes it gets to 12 o'clock and I think, do you know, I haven't even stopped for a drink today. So it's stopping, thinking, oh, do I need a glass of water? Do I need to have a 5-minute break from what I'm doing at the moment? And keeping learning. I mean, if anybody's listening to this, they've solved that one today because they're learning by listening to this today. So these aren't, you know, rocket science. These are really easy things to do. And if people practice them, it's the way of staying mentally well.
The image that people have of mental health is somebody who is mentally ill, somebody who has really serious problems. And what you're saying here is that actually you're describing a situation that we're all in.
The thing is, we do try and always separate mental health and physical health, but actually they're very overlapped. And all the research now is looking at how staying physically well and physically active actually really improves people's mental health. And people's mental health, if they stay fit mentally, will actually really help them to stay physically well as well. Because, you know, we do hold a lot of stress in our bodies. So if we learn ways of managing stress, the chances are our physical health will improve too.
Let's take an example. Somebody comes to you and they know that they have reached a point where the stress is getting on top of them, whether it's stress related to work or stress in family relationships or whatever it may be. What do they get from you? They knock on the door and say, I want some help. How does it work?
They would come in and they would fill in a form, and there's like a little tick box of lots of things that we offer, and they can tick what they see on there that they think they might be interested in. We would then invite them in for a meeting because they can fill that form in online, or we can post them a form, or they can drop into the office and fill the form in. That just gives us a starting point to talk. And then what we would be wanting to know is, what would they be hoping for from coming to see us? Perhaps they had financial difficulties. Then we might signpost them. We might be supportive in helping them go to the CAB. Could be that they're a bit anxious about going to the citizens' advice. We would just help them again bridge that gap between what we do and what other people do, make sure they get the right advice they need for their finances, their benefits. If you're feeling vulnerable, it can be really hard to tell somebody that you've got financial difficulties. But if through that first meeting they come in and they say, well, you know, feeling very stressed, we might be able to get to the bottom of it and then signpost them to get the right support and advice that they need, or come in and see us if they're having some relationship difficulties. It could be that they need counselling or want counselling. It could be that maybe just talking about it is enough. Having one session, coming and talking to somebody, having a consultation, can be just suddenly you think, oh, well, maybe I can find my way through this. That's what we would do.
Who would they be talking to?
We have a project officer and we have support workers, and they are qualified mental health workers, and they would be seeing one of them, either a senior support worker or our project officer. So we've got a project officer in each centre. We've got one here in St Albans, one in Welland, one in Hartford, or one of the senior support workers.
And behind the project officer, then, there are counsellors that are professional?
We've got 25 counsellors working across a wide range of different modalities. So people might be unaware that different people work different ways. So we have CBT therapists, but that doesn't fit for everybody. So cognitive behavioural therapy looks at how people are thinking, and perhaps if they could change their perspective, that might change about how they're feeling about things. Then we'd have like a psychodynamic therapist who's very much interested in perhaps what happened in somebody's childhood, how they learnt to be a human being in this world, what maybe roles they saw other people playing, and maybe those were good for them at one time in their life, but they're not serving them well now. So they might want to look at those and think, how can I change the way I think about that and give myself new choices? So I see counselling being about giving people more choices about how to live their life in a really healthy way. And then we have person-centred counsellors who are very much just listeners. They are very much listening to what somebody has to say rather than giving any direction. If somebody just feels like they need to have somebody to talk to, then a person-centred approach would work for that. But then you hear people say, well, all the counsellor did was sit and listen, and that wasn't very helpful. So then we would want to give them something a little bit more directive. So the first meeting is actually also looking at that. What kind of talking is going to be helpful? And it could be that joining an art group would be more helpful, that actually just being with people who maybe might be like-minded might also be struggling a little bit with their health and their stress levels, and actually just sitting in a room and chatting about the weather and doing a bit of art might be all you need just to relieve the stress, to be thinking about something else. But we also do things like mindfulness, and we have women's only groups, we have men's only groups. We run a whole variety of things. Art's very popular.
What,
so we
is that?
Run. I think because, you know, we often forget about how creative we can be. We're so fixated on being productive without thinking that art can just be fun. We don't have to be Picasso. And so actually just getting people in touch with their own creativity can be really meaningful when people have perhaps forgotten about being creative. You know, we live our lives being productive, doing work and earning money and making ends meet. I'm not saying those things are wrong, but sometimes when people are feeling very stressed, actually just remembering what fun it can be to be creative can really be life enhancing.
And you talked about having women's groups and men's groups. How many people might that be?
We try not to get the groups too big because sometimes people find that overwhelming. So they're normally no more than 12. If they get really popular, we might stretch it more than that. But quite often they're 6 or 8.
People sit around and talk about their own problems, is that?
Tend to talk about whatever's going on for them at the moment. And generally the leader would give them a theme. What are people doing around exercise or nutrition or something like that? So we try and keep it quite optimistic and positive. If people need to talk about their problems, sometimes that can be better done on a one-to-one basis. Sometimes they do talk about the problems because sometimes people don't want to feel like they're the only one that has problems, and that can be quite helpful. We let people very much lead the group, but the leader would be looking at trying to maintain some healthy aspect to it so that it doesn't just become everybody making everybody else unhappy.
You've talked about 25 counsellors.
We do have some paid counsellors, but the majority of our counsellors are volunteers. Some of them are on placement, so some of them are training. We don't accept anybody in their first 2 years of training, so everybody will be at least in their third year, and then we obviously will supervise all of those counsellors. We don't charge. We say people can pay what they can afford, and some people can pay £2. So it's a very low-cost service, which does mean we've got a bit of a waiting list, because obviously there's a lot of people out there who can't afford private therapy, and there's a limited amount on the NHS that you can get, so people are very happy to come to us, but they probably will have to wait a bit. Not for a consultation, like we would call a consultation being just coming to talk about one thing, but if they need counselling over a period of weeks, then they would need to wait for that. Staff-wise, we've got about 38 members of staff. Quite a lot of those are part-time. Some of them are sessional workers, and we really rely on our volunteers who support those groups that we were talking about, the arts and crafts groups. They're often led by volunteers. People come in, they help us with admin, they perhaps will answer the telephone, they will lead support groups, as well as the counselling. So obviously all our trustees are all volunteers. So we have about 100 volunteers at the moment across our 4 centres. And what can be really valuable is having volunteers with lived experience. So we do encourage people who have used our services to volunteer, because that can be really helping somebody who's perhaps doesn't feel they can recover, perhaps feels in quite a dark place, and then to meet somebody who's been there can be really helpful.
And you're providing what is either a free service or can be a very low cost service, yeah, to the user. How are your funds?
About half of our funding comes from what's called integrated commissioning, which is Hearts County Council. So some of that money comes from health and some of it comes from the County Council, which is local taxpayers. The other half of our funding is coming from a variety of places, some grants that we've applied for. So we have a grant from the Lloyds Bank Foundation, various different grant funders. Henry Smith, probably the general public haven't heard of these people, but I mentioned the Lloyds Bank because they would remember that one. And then smaller grants and fundraising. We do quite a lot of fundraising, and we're very lucky that sometimes big businesses, like at the moment Morgan Sindel, who's next door and is building at the moment, redeveloping the old museum, they came to see us and they said, well, you know, as we're making a lot of noise and inconveniencing you, maybe we could support you as a charity. And so they made us their charity of the year. So then they'll do various things throughout the year, which will raise money for us.
You've got a waiting list.
Yes.
So that means that you haven't got either enough room, enough people, or enough cash.
We don't have enough room. The rent here is very high. You can imagine in St. Albans City Centre. We feel we need to be in city centres so that we are as accessible as possible. We don't want people to have to get 2 buses to get to us. So funding is always an issue. We would love to have more space. If we had more space, I think we could double what we do here in St. Albans.
Could you get the professionals and the volunteers to cope with that?
Oh, yes. We were very fortunate. I think because we do a good service, people really like coming to us. They really like working for us and they really like volunteering for us. We're very fortunate. People aren't the problem. It's the money and the space. Quite a lot of people who come and see us actually give us a donation, quite a substantial donation, just because they're grateful for what they've received. It's really heartwarming. Sometimes it's the small donations that actually mean the most.
You're dealing with people of all ages. You've mentioned people who might be working with students smoking in schools. Do you deal with children?
No, 16 and over. We do have a family therapy clinic on a Saturday morning, but that's in Stevenage, and we would see families with children. We would work with children in schools. We're very happy to go in and do assemblies and talk about mental health, and again, just really encourage children to talk and not to bottle things up. The rate of self-harm in England is the highest in Europe. So our young people are struggling out there and there just isn't enough services for them. So although we're not children orientated in terms of helping them recover from mental health issues, again, we want to work on the prevention stuff. So we'll go into schools and do talks. And we're also part of a Spot the Signs, Save a Life campaign, which is a suicide prevention service, which again is training in schools and colleges. And also in any organisation that asks us, we'll go along and do Spot the Signs training. So it's really getting people to talk about suicide, because sometimes people are frightened that if they mention the word, it might make it happen, where actually the opposite is true. The more we talk about suicide, the less likely it is to happen. People will bottle things up. And when you say to somebody, you know, are you thinking of hurting yourself, or do you think you'd be better off dead? The relief on their faces just to have somebody who's brave enough to mention it and they can talk about it, and you're preventing it from happening then, because they bottle it up and think nobody cares. So we just want to make sure that nobody thinks that's the only way out. We want to make sure that everybody in Hertfordshire understands that there is somebody who does care and who will listen. So the Spot the Signs is all about just encouraging people to talk about suicide, spotting the signs in case we think somebody might be having suicidal thoughts, and what they should do if they do spot the signs. And that training is free. The NHS are leading on it. So that training is available across Hertfordshire. So anybody who would like to do that, there are open courses which people can just sign up for, or if they work for an organisation that would like us to come in and deliver that, we'll deliver it anywhere, in businesses, in corporations, in St Albans Council, wherever they are, we'll come. And particularly, obviously, we've been very successful in delivering that with voluntary services, because those volunteers and their staff are very keen to have that training, but we really want to get out to everybody. The campaign's been going for about 4 years. We targeted GPs first, because the research shows that people who take their own life, something like 80% of those people saw their GP in the 2 weeks before they took their own life. So we targeted GPs to spot the signs.
I know from looking at your website, you've got a whole lot of services, and we've only, in a sense, only touched on some of them. So
yes.
I would certainly encourage people to go to the website and see the whole range of things.
But yes,
and then
do.
To get in contact with you if they feel that any of it's relevant to them. Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And that brings our magazine programme to a close. Thanks to Goffby for our theme music, Briefly Encountered, and to Alison for collecting all the wallets you return. And thanks to you, too, for listening. We hope you enjoyed our selection today. Bye for now.